Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's the 25th of April, 2012 here in Japan, the 24th of April, 2012 in the United States, where I'm joined on the line by Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a former supervisory special agent in the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Crime Laboratory from 1986 to 1998, and the person who blew the whistle on the misconduct taking place in that crime lab during some of the FBI's biggest investigations in recent history, including its investigation into the WTC bombing of 1993 and the Oklahoma City bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in 1995. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, I'm glad to be here, sir.
Well, the immediate context of our conversation today is a new series of reports that has broken at the Washington Post under the headline, Convicted Defendants Left Uninformed of Forensic Flaws Found by Justice Department. And this gets into the history of your case and the FBI crime lab in general. Let's talk a little bit about what this story is revealing and the significance of it.
Okay, what's happening here is, while I was at the FBI crime lab, a number of us there realized that there were problems. I found it strange that we knew there were problems in the crime lab, but we wouldn't talk about it publicly. We were required by law to talk about it publicly. We were required by the Constitution to reveal things, and yet those things became, they were just secrets, open secrets within the FBI headquarters and the FBI community. I reported my concerns to the U.S. Department of Justice Inspector General over a period of about 5 years in 237 letters, just as a kind of train of thought, if you will. And that resulted in an investigation by the DOJ IG, and they found that indeed there were some very real problems in the crime lab. Our intent at the time was to stop it and fix it, and then we wanted to know who got hurt and to see that the people who'd been hurt by this bad work product were given a fair chance at justice instead of, essentially hung out to dry. I left the FBI in 1998 and, with the assistance of the National Whistleblower Center, formed what we call the Forensic Justice Project. And the Forensic Justice Project has as one of its projects, if you will, attempted to find the names of every case in which any of the 12 individuals that were named by the IG's report, in which any of those individuals were involved, and just to gather that information. I guess it's been about, a year ago that the Washington Post approached us following the exoneration of one of the victims of that those misdeeds, or that misplaced enthusiasm by the agents. Anyhow, the Washington Post approached us and said, what have you got, and can you give us that information? We have literally tens of thousands of files from the FBI, and we've been collecting them now for over 10 years through Freedom of Information Act. We've cataloged the information from one of the individuals as an example of what can be done with this information. And that was essentially the that information was what we provided to the Washington Post. And they springboarded off that and did an excellent, excellent investigation themselves with a lot more assets than we've got. So that's essentially what you see there. People were falsely accused. The FBI went in and supported those false allegations with bad science. And people were then sent off to prison, and some of them still imprisoned.
That's a staggering and chilling story for obvious reasons. The fact that this could be done and that it could be covered up and then continued to cover up for years, even after the Justice Department knew about the flaws in that investigation. So are there any specific cases that we can talk about with regards to this?
Well, I think the thing that cracked the shell here that started the Washington Post's interest was the case of Donald Eugene Gates. The Washington, D.C. Public Defender's Office was able to gather enough information without having any idea we even existed to determine that Mr. Gates was actually innocent of the charges he was in prison for. Before they were able to have him exonerated, through DNA evidence. He had spent 28 years in prison for crimes he did not commit. The Innocence Project, Barry Shagg, Peter Neufeld's brilliant and continuing effort to find innocents incarcerated. And the Innocence Project said years ago, if DNA is finding out that they're innocent, what happened that forensic science made them guilty? What is it? What is the failures of forensic science? And what are the failures of the justice system that made them guilty? that was the question that we were asking and was asked when Donald Eugene Gates' case came into the media. Well, how did this happen? And Judge Ugast, I understand from the bench in D.C., demanded to know how it happened. And normally when something like this happens to the FBI, they respond with heartfelt concern, well, we'll get right on it. And then the interest goes away. And I'm saying not to the FBI's interest, the interest of whoever asked the question goes away. We were able at that time to say the individual who wrote the report, the forensic report that was responsible for Mr. Gates's incarceration, we'd been studying for 13 years, and we had identified over 1,800 files, cases that he'd been involved in. And we give that information to you for nothing right now, free. So the FBI can say, we'll get around to it in 15 more years. We could say, well, you've already gotten around to it. And that's what we were talking about doing, 12, 13 years ago when this project started. So gather information. We can't, we don't have the assets to free people. I'm an attorney, but I'm just an old country lawyer. But we can gather the information, catalog it, and sometimes someone's going to come along and wonder and want to know. And it's just a quiet, laborious, expensive process during which the government does everything they can to avoid giving us information, anything at all. And we just keep crunching the Freedom of Information Act machine, if you will, and getting more and more information.
Well, as horrific as it is to think of losing 28 years of your life to a faulty investigation that incorrectly fingered you for some crime that you didn't commit, there's, of course, other cases with even more tragic consequences. And the Washington Post article notes one Texas case, Benjamin Herbert Boyle was executed in 1997, more than a year after the Justice Department began its review. Boyle would not have been eligible for the death penalty without the FBI's flawed work, according to a prosecutor's memo. So, of course, the consequences here are just absolutely unthinkably grave. And in the light of that, and in the light of this information coming to light and the Justice Department not giving this information to the defendants and their lawyers, that's almost unthinkable. It's quite staggering to think about. And yet the Justice Department is still claiming that they have met their legal and constitutional obligations to actually inform the prosecutors, and they are not required to inform the defendants. What does that really say about the type of system that we're dealing with right now?
Well, it's sort of draconian, really. It's sort of like the Gestapo troopers saying, I was following orders. I think we got rid of that concept with the Nuremberg trials. But people knowing fully well that there could be folks incarcerated and then supporting that, well, I'm doing my job. This is all I'm supposed to do. That's what got us where we are right now. People in the crime lab would say, well, it's up to the defense attorney to ask the questions, to force us to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And they'd go in and they would testify in such a way that it would support guilt. It wouldn't support educating triers of fact. It'd support manipulating triers of fact. So the Department of Justice saying, well, I just did my job. They can do that, sir. They can do that because there's no accountability there. I'm sure that Mr. Gates feels kind of bad about 28 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And now being an old man like me, and there's no, all of that life is gone. And, the other two fellows that were pointed out that we hadn't even found the Washington Post found the other two cases. It's horribly frightening that our Department of Justice will turn its back on the Americans, American citizens, and make an excuse, oh, well, the law doesn't require any more than this. I think it points us towards a solution, though. We would ask that the U.S. Congress pass laws that stop that excuse from being applied. That, hey, if you made a mistake, you need to go back and fix it. If the laws are wrong, then we need to fix those laws. And just very solidly, you're going to go help these people that you hurt.
Well, of course, we run the risk of people getting the wrong impression that the FBI crime lab's errors were simply mistakes that were then covered up. But unfortunately, with your case, what your case uncovered was that there was much, much bigger systemic problems with the FBI crime lab and people knowingly altering evidence. Perhaps you can talk about some of the experiences that you had during your time there.
Well, as soon as I entered the lab, I saw that it was an unprofessional environment. We were trying to find tiny amounts of material in areas that were obviously contaminated, and you didn't know whether the material came from the crime scene or the crime lab. I was there 5 years when I found an individual had been altering my reports, without authorization, my authorization or even knowledge. Evidence was manipulated. People were testifying in court to expertise that they didn't have. It was mind-boggling to see it going on, knowing it was going on, talking to my managers about it, and then saying, well, we realize this is going on, but it's not your cross to bear. But it was. It was my cross to bear. It was every American's cross to bear. You're just not going to do it. I've got a badge and I've got an oath of office, and we've got specific requirements to report fraud, waste, abuse, and corruption, and any indication of misconduct, the appropriate authority. What happened was I tried to solve the issues. I and fellow scientists in the lab, I wasn't the only person. We tried to solve the issues within the laboratory. Let's get to the bottom of this. Let's find out if anybody got hurt. Our managers were absolute unmitigated cowards all the way to the director's office. Absolute cowards. They did anything at all, and they're still today doing anything at all to stop revelations that might free innocent people. And they're going out of their way to do that. And you know, sir, they know they're doing that. They realize the reputation of the FBI is more important than individual freedom in this country. When I saw what I saw, a dirty lab, unvalidated protocols, open racism at times, just you name it, there's a whole list of it. I went forward and tried to talk to people about it. And there were some colleagues who supported me all the way through to testifying for Senate and congressional hearings. But managers, all managers did, sir, was to try and cover it up. It's sort of Enron in law enforcement. Let's do anything we can to get to that county line of retirement and get our, even up to and including Director Louis Free, anything at all to stop this, to cover it up.
Well, let's talk about one of the specific cases that you worked on. Obviously, we've just passed the 17th anniversary of the tragedy at the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And one of the incidents that you were reporting on was due to some just unbelievable testimony that was given at the trial of Terry Nichols. And I understand this revolves around a forensic scientist in the FBI crime lab named Stephen Burmeister, who actually lied on the stand about the ammonium nitrate crystals that were found or supposedly found on the OKC bombing building. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Actually, Stephen Burmeister was my student, and he was really he understood, and in fact, really about a third of the issues that I brought forward came from him. He was an FBI agent, but you know, he had a career that he was worried about, and he didn't want to come forward himself. And so he would raise the issues with me, And he was my student and then my partner. And then as time went on and, you know, I was going to be relieved of being an explosives examiner, I turned my assets over to him and he moved into my position and then went up management. There was a specimen at the crime scene. It was Q specimen, question specimen 507, Q507, which had crystals on it. And the question was, they were ammonium nitrate crystals. And the question was, how could they have gotten there? And it was a very strange situation because all these materials came off of and landed all over the place, and people were walking around the crime scene, which was a huge crime scene, trying to find pieces and parts of whatever that might be clues leading to how did this happen. When the bomb went off very quickly after that, it was very hard rain in the area. Ammonium nitrate crystals, which were adhering to Q507, was remarkable that they survived, as the Oklahoma folks call, a gully wash and rainstorm. Ammonium nitrate dissolves right now. In fact, even in the 20% humidity of the FBI laboratory, we had trouble keeping them from absorbing water and changing form when we were trying to determine the crystalline structure of them. And the crystals themselves, if they were embedded in Q507, then that would have meant they might have been driven into it by force. Well, I looked at Q507. Steve called me in the room to look at it. And the crystals, they were on the surface. They weren't embedded. But that became the issue in the trial. It was my opinion at the time that he gave false and misleading testimony about that particular aspect. And it wasn't that big a deal, except, you know, I mean, it wasn't that important a piece of evidence. That there was ammonium nitrate crystals on there could have been argued another way. How did they get there? The piece itself was mishandled by a trainee who was on the crime scene. But how could they have gotten there? Well, if they were driven into the Q507, that would have meant they came from the blast. And I frankly didn't see that when I looked through the microscope. And that's what that testimony was in the Nichols matter that Steve had given, in my opinion, false testimony during the trial.
So what are the implications of that for the case that was used to convict Nichols and McVeigh?
You know, the implications go beyond whether that particular piece of evidence was important or not to how far would the government go to manipulate the trier of fact to get the jurors to believe something. How far would they go? At the crime laboratory, it was a regular practice for people to testify outside their area of expertise. One agent altered my reports for 5 years, as I said, most of which were altered to support the prosecutor. When you have that kind of activity by the government, if jurors are made aware of it, then you have what, you know, some of us call the O.J. Simpson factor. There were so many people in law enforcement that lied in the O.J. Simpson trial, in his criminal trial, that no one was going to believe anything law enforcement said. The American public is, we're not, you know, they're not stupid. They're as bright and intelligent as any FBI agent. If they believe they're being lied to, we think that that would cause distrust of the government's position. So that's really the implication there. Does it mean Terry Nichols was guilty or Timothy McVeigh was guilty or innocent or whatever? No. The implications are, sir, that we are seeking a fair trial. And between us and what's happening in Syria right now is our justice system. It's not army. It's not, police force or whatever. It's because we think we can go before a judge and a jury and get a fair trial. If we lose that, then, you know, there's an expression out there, if justice fails, violence prevails. And we've seen that in this nation before. We saw it in the 60s. We saw it in the 60s, 100 years before that. I saw it in Vietnam. I don't want to see it again. But if you can't be treated fairly anywhere, if the rule of law is based upon the rule of might, then, well, there's a lot more citizens than there are government. And people think that way. I mean, there's just, you know, and I am not advocating that at all. That's why I spent this professional life trying to see that fairness is in that process.
Well, an extremely important point, and one that I think that the listeners should hopefully cogitate on. But before we move off of this, there's one other aspect of the work that you did at the Crime Lab that I thought was absolutely fascinating, and it does relate to the World Trade Center bombing investigation and the FBI Crime Lab's claim that they had detected urea nitrate as the explosive residue of the blast. And you did some rather unorthodox things to show that that conclusion was not justified. Perhaps you can tell us that story.
Sure. When a urea nitrate explosive is detonated, the urea nitrate breaks into urea and nitrate. Nitrate ions, urea is out there. And we found high concentrations of urea at the World Trade Center. And we found urea nitrate explosive at a bomb-making factory, which we could point back to the folks at the that were the suspects. And I wrote a report that we found urea nitrate ions, and that was consistent with the presence of a urea nitrate-based explosive. However, it was also consistent with the urea, which is used on the streets of New York at the time, is a bio-friendly ice melter. Nitrate ions, which are in the acid rain belt, urea is in sewage. It's coming out of your fingers right now. It's it's something that it's in urine. Sewage mains burst in the crime scene, you know, as a result of the explosion, World Trade Center. FBI management ordered my boss to tell me to take those alternative explanations for the data out of my report. And I remember the day very well. It was raining. It was dreary out on East Street behind the FBI building. I was looking out the window, and I told my boss, well, they can just fire me. I'm not going to lie in this report. I'm going to lie in a court of law. Well, ultimately, they just fired me because they needed somebody to lie. But another individual in the lab decided to just come in and give them the answer they wanted. And when he put himself in that position, in order to convince our managers that these things were true, Steve Burmeister, my partner at the time, and I made some samples and told the fellow they came from the crime scene. One of them was actually urine. I collected my own urine in a beaker and dried it down and extracted it with acetone and turned that sample over to this fellow. And then Steve Burmeister mixed urea nitrate or urea fertilizer and ammonium nitrate and gave it to the guy. And his response in detecting these things was, okay, we got them now. That was urea nitrate bomb. And then we went to our manager and said, oh, here's the problem. And this is what's going to catch you when you get to court. This guy is ready to declare a urea nitrate bomb. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's not trained in explosive analysis. He doesn't understand chemistry. He doesn't even have a degree in chemistry. And yet he's being declared as your chief chemist, and you're going to put him up front to make a point that's going to blow this case all apart, and it's going to show the government's going to lie in court. And so we told the manager what we did. The manager absolutely blew up at us. We couldn't. We were astonished. What do you mean? You know, I'm not going to embarrass my chief chemist, and don't you ever do anything like this again. Well, you know, Mike Isikoff at the Newsweek magazine at the time wrote the incident up that I was so frustrated at management, I got a beaker and urinated in it. And that's where he stopped. Made me look sort of like a fool. But that's what, I chide Mike about that all of these years when he calls me every once in a while. That isn't what happened. That is what happened was we showed that this individual, without any realization of what he was, what his data meant, was willing to make a statement in a court of law that was completely false, completely, and would have made that, would have very much threatened that prosecution or that case.
Once again, just an incredible story, and one that I hope at least gives people pause for thought about the type of evidence that that has been and can be presented. So obviously, you have devoted yourself to continuing the task of attempting to correct the mistakes of justice, as it's been put. But if there was an end point to that task that you could envision, what would that look like?
You know, part of it looks like right now, regularly I review FBI laboratory work product. I'm not only a practicing attorney, but I'm also a forensic consultant. And the group of people or the unit that was producing a work product 25 years ago that was thoroughly flawed is now doing a really great job. And I find human error, but I don't find deceit. There's a unit chief of that unit. His name is Greg Carl. There's a senior scientist there. His name is Kurt Yeager. They're putting out a product and seeing that a product is put out that's fair. And, you know, I don't see every case that comes out. I see very few of them. But it meant something. You know, people couldn't keep me around there. You can't sue your boss, the director of the FBI, and the president, and you still work for them, okay? But they did listen. The scientist that they brought in, and Greg Carl is a scientist, and I don't know if he's still there. I haven't looked at the work product just absolutely recently, but those people are putting out, and the people they're bringing in are putting out a good work product. Again, there's some flaws. Now, that's part of the end. If you go through the mantra of stop it, fix it, then find out who got hurt. We don't have a mechanism in this country to determine when science sees that it was terribly wrong before and presented in a court of law to determine who was harmed by that bad science. There were people at the FBI crime lab who were doing really bad, bad work, but they didn't realize it. They believed in their work. They weren't scientists. They were degreed folks and history and English literature and whatever. They shouldn't have been doing chemical analysis or, you know, but they believed in their work product. If they were wrong, we have no way to revisit that. If you imagine that one examiner can, over his career, look at 2,500 cases and say, you know, a 10-year period of time, and if he is deceitful or a serial criminal, if you will, that's 2,500 cases out of one guy. And going back and revisiting all of those cases is a huge, huge job. If you extrapolate that to the total forensic community in our country, which is they're outside the mainstream of science. Most of those crime labs are not doing scientific work product. If you extrapolate to that, the effect on our justice system, on individual lives, is just it's horrific. It's a holocaust of justice is what it amounts to. So the end product here doesn't end with me, sir. The end product ends with us, all of us, as bricks in a wall of justice, not as a wall, but as bricks in a wall, moving forward, admitting our mistakes, trying to make right what we did, trying to recover people's lives where we made mistakes, and moving forward. The Department of Justice in this trying to find out who got hurt, they're still doing everything they can to harm those people, to cover that up. And so what's the end product? The end product will be a long time after I'm off. I'm getting to be an old man. It'll be a long time after I'm gone.
Well, finally, let's talk about the National Whistleblower Center and your work with that organization.
Sure, I'm on the board of directors, and Oh, the National Whistleblower Center has been around. Oh, my goodness. I got there in 92, and it had been there for, I don't know, 7, 8 years before I got there. They represent people that are blowing the whistle on something, that are reporting indications of or actual the reality of misconduct in the government or in industry. They're fearless, if you will, warriors for that. Very, very well versed in, you know, in whistleblower law and in employment law. People come to the Whistleblower Center and they've got a problem. And the first thing most folks do is they say, here's the problem, you solve it, and they leave. The Whistleblower Center wants to know that you're going to be a partner with them tomorrow, the next day, a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, that you're going to dedicate all of what you are, because there are just not enough people in the country to fix every problem that there is. We're a human enterprise. But representing folks like me and Jane Turner, another FBI agent who came forward, and you know, there's just a whole blended trip. There's a whole line of folks that blew the whistle on misconduct and then stuck there with it until the, you know, till the end game. I'm right now working with 4 different people, and I'm, you know, I won't tell you who they are, but what happens is the whistleblowers' lives are pretty much ruined. These are patriots who have said, you know, if I die from this, then I die from it, but my country is more important than me and my family, me and my career, whatever. The Whistleblower Center initiated the Forensic Justice Project, and it was through the Whistleblower Center attorneys that we did our Freedom Information Act. It was through the Forensic Justice Project that we have looked at all of these cases from the FBI Crime Lab. Back about 2005, the FBI ceased using a forensic technique they call comparative bullet lead analysis. The technique was first approached to look at it by Professor Jacqueline Benn out of New Jersey back in 1999, in August 1999. And we collected transcripts. We did scientific research. The FBI's retired chief metallurgist, William Tobin, did the research, scientific research, and proved that that was not a validated protocol. And after 6-7 years of the FBI fighting us tooth and nail, they won't come to the table with us, they won't listen, they won't agree that they've been wrong since, in that particular technique, using it since 1965. Thousands of people unfairly accused by that. But they gave in. They had the National Academy of Science brought to the table to look at it. National Academy of Science said they were wrong. They never could have done that. The Forensic Justice Project, under the National Whistleblower Center, looks at work product all over the country. And we are not forming opinions necessarily about the work product. We're just gathering information so that scientists, not forensic scientists, but scientists can look at it and form scientific opinions, not opinions biased by a need to prosecute and imprison and find guilt. Hmm.
Well, as you know, Dr. Whitehurst, the fight for justice and accountability is far from over. So on that note, people who are interested in the National Whistleblower Center can go to whistleblowers.org for the website of that organization. But for people who are specifically interested in your work and the FBI Crime Lab, are there any resources that you would direct them towards?
Well, I'll tell you, every bit of data that we've collected, we give it away to anybody for nothing. Okay, we've got literally hundreds of thousands of hours on it. We would hope that there's a resource someplace that we can just put this. These are the Freedom Information data. We can just put it that people interested in a particular case, interested in cataloging the information. We only looked at one examiner of the 12, and we have thousands and thousands of files where there's scientific error. We've provided that information, for instance, to the Innocence Project, to the state of Florida, to another number of entities around, and people that are interested. If there's somebody out there that hears you and says, "Hey, well, this is great. I wonder how I could get that information. I wonder how we could seek to determine innocence or at least unfairness." But how do we get that information? Well, you go to the National Whistleblower Center and say, "I'd sure like that," and send me a disc. And if you've got a place to put it, I'd love for you to put it. Put it up there and let it. I shouldn't be the door that you've got to go through. It needs to be up on the cyberspace for anybody to view, so that we not one of us, but we as bricks in a wall, can make it a stronger wall. Do you understand what I'm saying, sir?
I do indeed, and certainly in the wired cyber world that we live in, the wonderful wired world, there must be a way to make that happen. So certainly I hope that that somehow this will be able to come to fruition, and hopefully there will be some sort of online repository for this information you've been collecting.
That would really be cool.
Well, on that note, if there's anyone out there in the audience, perhaps they can get their mental gears spinning on this issue. But on that note, we'll leave it there for now. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a pleasure and an honor talking to you. Thank you so much for your time and for your dedication.
You're welcome, sir.